Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to another edition of Studio 471. My guest is Charles Carmichael, who's the CTO of Mandiant, which is now part of Google Cloud. Thank you very much for joining me, Charles.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
So ransomware this year seems to be absolutely off the hook. Like we've noticed increasing attack volumes. It appears that some of the companies that do blockchain analytics, it looks like that organizations are, on average, also paying more to attackers. What's your sense of the state of play?
Yeah, look. Ransomware and multifaceted extortion, it's the number one way in which financially motivated criminals choose to monetize their intrusions. Gone are the days where they break into companies to steal credit card information and try to sell those credit card numbers to make, $100,000 here or $1 million there. They realize that they could conduct intrusion operations in a few days and then extort a company for $5 million or $10 million. And the fact of the matter is, Jeremy, plenty of organizations are paying. Now, this year versus last year versus the year before, it's kind of interesting to see the dynamics. So let me start with 2021. 2021 felt like one of the worst years from a threat perspective. We had the attack against Colonial Pipeline. It was the first time that we saw a kinetic consequence to a cyber action. Now, it wasn't a direct result of the hack. The hackers didn't shut off the pipeline. Colonial Pipeline did. But it was the first time that people actually saw a cyber attack and really felt the impact at a very large scale, where
Yes.
people, like everyday people, were talking about it. Then a few months later, you see this attack against customers of Kaseya, anywhere between 1,000 to about 1,500 organizations, many of them smaller ones, were impacted by ransomware. And so, when you think about the impact in 2021, it felt like one of the worst years from a threat perspective. From a law enforcement perspective, it was actually one of the best years. We saw half of the money that Colonial Pipeline paid to the threat actor was reclaimed by law enforcement. We saw the decryptor that was essentially made by the our evil threat actor was somehow obtained by law enforcement and provided to victim organizations. We saw lots of seizures of attacker infrastructure and tumbling services. We saw indictments of criminals and we saw arrests. So things are pretty good from that perspective. 2022, things got a little bit interesting. So obviously you had the war in Ukraine between Russia and Ukraine. And I think that really consumed a lot of offensive capability and talent from Russia. And it also created a lot of divide between threat actors that collaborated, that lived or were aligned with Ukraine versus those that lived or were aligned with Russia.
Yes.
And there's a number of groups, Conti, for example, that kind of stood up and said, we are aligned with Russia and with Russian interests. And that really irritated the Ukrainian members of Conti, which we know what happens. We saw the Conti leaks, and we it's the first time that we got to see, or the public got to see, the great inner workings of how a multifaceted extortion operation across multiple groups operates. But one thing we noticed toward the end of 2022 is that, ransomware kind of seemed to be a bit on the decline. The numbers were still high, but it wasn't as alarming as it was in 2021. And perhaps that's because there's just so many things going on. There were tons of attacks from a multifaceted extortion perspective. There are also tons of destructive attacks against, organizations in Ukraine, critical infrastructure, government entities, and other major organizations. And I think capacity was somewhat constrained as, people are trying to figure out what to do. 2023, this year's shaping up to be, unfortunately, a pretty bad year from a cyber threat
Yes.
perspective. We're seeing lots of threats, multifaceted extortion, again, still the number one way in which financially motivated threat actors are monetizing their intrusions. But we're also seeing, intrusions that look kind of like extortion or look kind of like ransomware, but aren't directly related to ransomware. And let me give you just a few examples. So, we're seeing some new entrants or newer entrants into the game where they are causing disruption in ways that are different than what we've seen in the past with, traditional criminals deploying ransomware. We're seeing a lot of business disruption through breaking web proxies of companies or, logging into EDR solutions in an enterprise where the threat actor is using that solution to contain a number of systems, whether it's user workstations or critical systems, and stopping them from connecting to the internet, or getting so deeply entrenched within an organization that the organization feels the best way to contain the incident is to start shutting systems down. And that shutting of systems, you know, sometimes causes pretty big, you know, network disruptions. So we've seen plenty of outages this year that weren't directly related to ransomware encryptors, but were related to a threat actor doing something that was disruptive in another way, like shutting off systems, or the victim organization shutting things off themselves. So it's a interesting year. And in terms of the volume, we're seeing, you know, a pretty substantial volume of ransomware and ransomware-like events.
And I want to split attacks into, you've got ransomware, which is the file encrypting component, and then you've got some of the extortion-only attacks as well. But just specifically with ransomware, are organizations paying because they don't have write backups and they need the data and they haven't done the kind of preparation that's needed to be able to say, look, we don't need to pay you?
Yeah. Look, in our caseload, what we find is that, you know, about half the organizations we work with end up making a decision to pay the threat actor. And there's a variety of reasons why they do that. And I know it's pretty alarming to hear like how many people are paying, but most people don't pay because they don't have backups. I mean, today, and particularly for our client base, you know, we typically work with mature organizations that have backups. But where we run into issues is that most companies, when they architected their backup environment, they didn't think about it from the perspective of having a cyber attack bringing down every single system in an enterprise, where they would need to leverage their backup and restoration processes to restore every single server or every single workstation or laptop in an enterprise. And so, you know, sometimes people are paying threat actors to accelerate the recovery process. Maybe their backups were destroyed. Maybe they were, impacted somehow. Maybe they just didn't actually restore when they actually try doing it. But a lot of times it's just their backups and their infrastructure just wasn't built to be resilient enough to restore every single system in an environment. So they pay for speed. Sometimes organizations will end up paying, not because of the business disruption, but because of the potential harm and impact of data that was stolen and could potentially be exposed to the internet. So let me talk about a group that we call Fin11. You know, they self-identify as CLOP. And I'll just share one important point about this group. So they've conducted a number of mass extortion events, typically by exploiting a zero-day vulnerability in a managed file transfer product. We saw this in December 2020, January 2021 timeframe, as it relates to customers of the Accelion FTA product. We also saw it earlier this year for customers of the Fortra Go Anywhere product. And then everybody knows most recently we saw it with Progress Software's move to technology. But going back to early January, or actually I can't remember if it was January, but it was earlier this year with Fortra Go Anywhere, what we found at Mandiant is that most of the healthcare organizations that were impacted by this campaign ended up paying an extortion demand because they were worried about the harm in which published health records would be imposed upon the patients or the insureds of the organizations. And, Jeremy, you live in Australia, you're familiar with what happened with Medibank. And, I don't need to tell you, how Australians, kind of felt about that event last year. You know, people were upset when the threat actor published highly sensitive information about the insureds for Medibank. And the harm was imposed on the insureds or the patients more so than it was on the on the company itself. And the reason for that is because, people that had very sensitive medical procedures performed didn't want the world to know that that happened.
And absolutely, yes.
The rest of the world learned from that event, and they didn't want to be in the same situation that Medibank and the customers or insureds at Medibank had to live with.
So is it possible, because Australia stood up to extortionists, that that has actually made other organizations paradoxically pay?
You know, it's an interesting question, but you got to look at a few different variables. You got to think about, what did the threat actor choose to do? And what data did the threat actor have access to? You know, in this situation, the threat actor had access to highly sensitive medical information, and they chose to publish that. And they did that to impose harm on the organization, but also to people. So I don't want to blame any organization for the decision to pay or not to pay.
Absolutely.
But what I could tell you is that because of the actions, and you look at everything in aggregate, that is causing certain organizations to pay because they're concerned about the impact and the harm to people, you know, associated with the stolen data.
I want to ask you about, there's ideas to ban ransoms. This idea has come up again. This is a policy lever that some people are considering again. A couple of years ago, when the Ransomware Task Force came out with its first big report, experts were pretty divided on this and couldn't really say if that was a good policy lever. But now it's kind of coming back under consideration again. Is banning ransom something that we should think about again as a possible avenue? I think it's kind of alluring in a way because it's something that we can control when there's so many other uncontrollable factors related to, you know, cyber criminals acting with impunity from the other side of the world.
You know, look, I think it's always important to evaluate options. And one of those options is banning extortion and ransom payments. I don't think the timing is right to put a ban on that. Because if you ban that, you essentially take an option away from a victim organization that has very few options for restoring business operations or protecting their data. And I've realized it sounds kind of silly to say protecting their data because they'd already lost it at this point. But again, you want to minimize the likelihood of stolen data showing up on the internet, and you want to minimize the impact to those that are affected. And so, look, I think at some point in time, banning ransom and extortion payments may be the right option. But I think there's a lot of things that need to be done before we get to that point. I think we need to do a better job. You know, the governments of the world need to do a better job of helping to defend organizations by way of sharing threat intelligence. I think victim organizations need to be able to share information and knowledge freely without feeling like they're going to be penalized for, you know, dealing with a cybersecurity event. I think governments have to take more action against threat actors. I talked about 2021. The world took a lot of action against a number of threat actors because of what they did to Colonial Pipeline and what they did to Kaseya. And there's obviously other things and other drivers that cause really good actions. We have the potential to really cause pain and to cause disruption to threat actors. And by the way, in 2021, toward the end of the year, there were tons of criminals that started to reconsider, should they continue to do what they do for a day-to-day, you know, living perspective? Should they continue to hack into organizations? Because at this point in time, they were starting to really feel like there were real risks and repercussions of being part of a, you know, multinational criminal enterprise. That fear kind of went away as they stopped feeling and seeing the indictments. But anyways, bottom line is there's so many actions I think need to happen first. And then I think when we do all those other things, I think banning ransoms is probably one of the final steps that need to be taken.
Let's talk a little bit on the practitioner side and in defense. You know, you do a lot of IR. What do you see organizations doing right in regards to, I guess, just ransomware and access these days?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we love to see organizations do is just to try to emulate real-world adversaries and test their network to try to find ways in which they could break into their organization. And do it in a way where you don't tell the rest of the organization that this work's being done. That way you can measure the detection efficacy of the security operations team. You could test the response time and the way that the organization is responding to attacks. And it also allows you to kind of match up, you know, the attacks with the defenses just to see, like, can you see all the tests and all the actions that an adversary or a tester is actually taking? And you'll identify blind spots, no question about it. And it gives you the opportunity. When the good guys are doing these tests, it'll give you the opportunity to find ways to create detections and to better and more effectively respond to attacks. Another thing that I really like seeing organizations do is, you know, kind of practicing and playing out a real-world scenario of a real-world attack. And there's a few different ways in which they should play this out. There's a way in which, you know, the technical teams should be playing this out, you know, from a tabletop perspective and figuring out roles and responsibilities, testing out hypotheses, making sure that they test assumptions and test, you know, the ways in which they would communicate and who would own what. It's also good to do that at the executive level, because I think a lot of times business leaders just make the assumption that cybersecurity and ransomware is a CIO or a CISO problem. And it's much broader than that. You know, and I think what a lot of execs realize is that, you know, there's a number of decisions that a CEO has to make, that a CFO has to make. And I think, you know, I think people understand general counsels have a much larger involvement in data security events nowadays. But it's good to test hypotheses. It's good to test assumptions. It's good to create some more awareness and get some practice. And you'll never get it perfectly, even when you do, you know, live through a real event. But it's good to get as prepared as you can. That way you're learning less when you go through a real event than you would if you didn't have any practice at all.
Mannion's MTrends report that came out earlier this year pointed out some really interesting statistics in that vulnerability exploitation was 32%. So it was almost the leading factor for organizations getting compromised. The second was phishing, unsurprisingly, at around 22%, and then followed by credential theft. What are you seeing as far as, I guess, patch management programs and vulnerability remediation? Is that getting any easier? I know that you know, CISA's now has been doing the KEV, the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, which is past 1,000. They recently added a new tab to indicate whether one of those vulnerabilities was being exploited by ransomware groups. Have you seen that sort of awareness drift out into, you know, that KEV applies to federal government agencies, but do you see it having an effect outside of government circles as well?
So let me start with just kind of a few thoughts. When we initially did our analysis 2 years ago, and we realized that exploitation of vulnerabilities surpassed email-based phishing as the number one way in which threat actors broke into organizations, I was a bit surprised. I mean, as I look back on my caseload, it kind of made sense, but I was a bit surprised because, you know, for so long, email-based phishing and social engineering was the number one way in which threat actors broke in. Last year, when we did our analysis, yet again, we saw that the exploitation of vulnerabilities was the number one way in which threat actors broke in. And that time, I was less surprised because I was much more aware that that was a problem the year before. And, you know, as I was doing more and more incident response work in, you know, the subsequent year, I started realizing, oh, threat actors are exploiting a vulnerability in product X and product Y and, you know, product Z, and that's how they're getting in. So I was much more aware of that. I think, what do you think about the patch management paradigm? I think in general, Microsoft has done a really good job of making patch management relatively easy with Windows. There's, you know, ways in which systems can be automatically updated without anybody touching a system. There's easy ways to leverage technology to push out, you know, patches. There's a kind of a known frequency in which patches are released. So I think Microsoft's, you know, done a really good job in making the problem, you know, as manageable as it can. I think a lot of times where people tend to struggle, it's with the other technologies that exist, whether it's the appliances that they have living on their networks. It could be a security appliance. It could be, you know, a virtual machine hypervisor. It could be IoT devices. There's just a lot of technology that lives in an environment that, hey, lots of companies don't even know exist. So just getting a good handle on all the inventory out there is really, really difficult. And then B, even if you know what's out there, yeah, knowing that you need to patch something and kind of understanding when a new security vulnerability is out there that you have to, you know, address, it's really challenging, especially for organizations that have very, very large estates. Now, I really appreciate what organizations like CISA are doing. You know, not all security vulnerabilities are alike, and there are, you know, tens of thousands of security vulnerabilities that are out there. One thing that I really appreciate about what CISA does is they, you know, they've created that known exploited vulnerability list, which helps you prioritize, you know, what are the patches that are just so critical to apply because you know they're actively being exploited in the wild. And so it helps you with your prioritization. So, you know, I think things like that will help make the problem get better. But I think we've got a long way to go, particularly for, you know, a lot of the non-Windows-based technologists out there that just don't have really mature patching processes.
I want to ask you a bit about threat intelligence too. Like, what do you see as like the most valuable sort of threat intelligence that organizations are sort of employing when it comes to specifically to ransomware? Like, what do you see in cases that, like, what was the bit that helped them avert a successful, I guess, ransomware deployment?
Yeah, I mean, All right. So there's a few different ways to talk about this. Let me start with what we see a lot of, which is not necessarily the most effective use of threat intelligence, but it is a use and it'll help reduce risk. It's the consumption of indicators of compromise through, you know, threat intel feeds. And, you know, to some extent, that'll help, you know, block attacks, especially things that are seen. To some extent, it'll help organizations detect attacks retroactively based on historic hits to indicators of compromise. And to some extent, it will create a lot of work for security operations teams that are getting these alerts, but they're false positives. And being able to, you know, triage what's real and what's not real, you know, that's pretty tricky. But I think that's probably one of the most common uses of threat intelligence. You know, when I think about what organizations are doing to like really effectively mature their security capability, it's, you know, kind of taking all the learnings from, you know, notable breaches that occur or breaches that could look similar to what could potentially occur to an organization, kind of studying the tradecraft, studying the methodology, and building out capabilities to better, you know, detect, respond, and contain attacks throughout various phases of the attack lifecycle by emulating a variety of adversaries and a variety of threats. And let me give you a, you know, an example of something that, you know, many organizations are struggling to deal with right now. You know, there's a group, you know, CrowdStrike calls them Scattered Spider. The main int, we call them UNC3944 and a variety of other group names because there's a lot of different groups that are part of this broad clustering. But they typically break in through a few different ways. You know, number one, they pick up the phone and with a American or British or an Australian accent, will convince people to install software in their computers like AnyDesk. Or they'll convince them to go to a website that looks like the company's website. So maybe intel471-sso.com. And they'll see a login page that looks just like a normal Intel 471 login page. And somebody will, you know, using a web browser, will follow the instructions that they're receiving over the phone because they think they're talking to somebody from the Intel 471, you know, security team or tech team.
Yes.
And they'll provide their username and password and then maybe their multi-factor authentication code, which will allow the attacker to log in as them, you know, perpetually. So that's way number one. Way number two is we see the threat actor sending SMS phishes to people saying, you know, click this link to update your schedule or whatever the lore is. And this is tricky because corporations don't monitor inbound SMS messages.
Yes.
Nor do they have the ability to see network traffic. When somebody taps that link on their phone, that traffic isn't going through the company's, you know, network. So it's not going to go through all the security controls of the company. It's going out through the individual's mobile carrier. So that's another challenge. We see SIM swapping being used to facilitate intrusion. So the temporary hijacking of somebody's cell phone number, and then that person using that, or the attacker using that telephone number to request a one-time password to verify their identity and, you know, essentially assume the identity of somebody else. You know, we see issues where, you know, now with COVID and people working from home, a lot of times people are more willing to log into a company resource from their personal computer. And people think about security for their personal computer totally differently than they do with their corporate computer. So personal computers, they let their kids install software. Sometimes Yes. their kids install pirated software, and sometimes it comes laced with info stealers. So Yes. all it takes is for, you know, a parent to log into their work email address one time for an info stealer to catch the username, password, and the valid cookie. So those are, you know, some ways in which we see organizations, you know, becoming victims of threat actors like Scattered Spiders and plenty others. There's state actors that do the same thing as well.
And it's the social engineering vector that's so powerful, tricking people into doing something like resetting, you know, an MFA token on a different device, or they've really honed their methods to be able to do that. So as far as companies defending against it, is it sometimes yeah. saying like, hey, maybe we should just slow down. we don't need to reset the super admin MFA yeah. token right this second, right? Maybe we should try to verify that this person is who they say they are through an outside channel.
Yeah. So what I find is companies that deal with this problem, they tend to start to implement more enhanced identity verification methods, like asking people to turn on their webcam and, you know, do a Zoom call. Or maybe they'll ask them to three-way their supervisor on the phone and have voice identity verification that's performed. Yes. And so things like that make it harder for threat actors to assume the identity of somebody. And look, I think, you know, you'll probably hear a lot of stories about how effective, you know, scattered spidered individuals are at social engineering. And look, they're effective. There's no question about that. But I want to be very clear, you know, they're not, they don't have 100% success rate. So they're not picking up the phone and convincing every single person that they call to reset a password. They're failing a lot, but they're very persistent. They will make repeated phone calls. They will find somebody that'll end up visiting the website that they asked them to visit, or they'll find somebody that'll end up resetting a password for them. And I'll give you, you know, an example of, you know, an incident that we responded to where, you know, the person at the help desk wanted to be friendly and asked the threat actor to verify their identity by asking a number of challenge response questions, like, you know, what was your mother's maiden name? And what was the name of your, you know, fourth grade teacher, or whatever the questions were. The threat actor got all three of the questions wrong, but the person at the help desk wanted to be helpful and ended up resetting the person's password anyway. You know, there are situations like that. Now, that's not the norm, but it happens. And it just, all it takes is, you know, one person that's trying to be helpful to reset somebody's password. And it'll give the threat actor some initial foothold into the environment. And then it gives them the opportunity to take that foothold to the next level.
I want to ask you about Scattered Spider and its sort of alliance with ransomware. We've generally seen Eastern European and Russian threat actors actually say, we're not going to work with English speakers. However, it appears that this has happened in this case, which is a quite alarming sort of development. It's like this merging of two sort of spheres of cybercrime. What's your evaluation of what's kind of going on with that? And is that something that's going to become, you know, is this just sort of a kind of one-off thing? Or is this something that might develop into something, you know, even more serious?
Yeah, I have no doubt that other threat actors or more established ransomware and multifaceted extortion groups will end up collaborating with Western or English-speaking threat actors, because it's hard to deny the success of these English-speaking threat actors. I mean, they're breaking into organizations of some of the largest and the most mature, you know, with the largest and the most mature security teams out there. And they're successful because they are leveraging tradecraft that is really hard to defend against. And, you know, candidly, you know, a lot of organizations, I remember, you know, years ago, you know, pen testing shops would say, hey, you know, we should pick up the phone, we should, you know, social engineer organizations to see if we could convince them to install software. And I thought, you know, hey, that's cool. You know, it's a good test. But at the time, this was many years ago, I'd never seen a real world adversary pick up the phone and call somebody and convince them to do something. Now, that kind of changed. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Fin9 that started calling up hospitality companies, and they would send them, you know, Microsoft Office files or Excel files with macros, and they'd call up the hotel, like the front desk of the hotel, and they'd say, "Hey, I just sent you a file. Can you open it up and enable the macros?" And so we started seeing some of that, and so, you know, my perception of social engineering changed. But the notable thing about that was those folks had very thick accents when they called. Now, these people that are calling, and by the way, the people that are calling aren't necessarily the criminals that are actually, you know, putting their hand behind keyboard or doing all this advanced stuff, but they're the folks that are pretty good at social engineering, and they're good enough at convincing people to do things. And they will have, you know, different tactics. Sometimes they'll be really nice. Other times they'll be really aggressive and make the person feel like they're going to get fired because they didn't comply with the instructions of the security team. And so sometimes they get really hostile, and it scares people, especially people working in, you know, certain countries where they don't get paid a whole lot, and they're worried about losing their jobs and not being able to support their families. So it's really intimidating.
Absolutely. And I think we should also talk about strong authentication here, right? Because that's the defense, right? Hardware-based authentication would stop most of this kind of attacks. Do you see that being employed, or interest in that rising because of as the social engineering has become more clever and sophisticated?
Yeah, look, I'll tell you, you know, FIDO2 authentication, or, you know, hardware-based identity verification or multi-factor authentication, I mean, it'll dramatically reduce the attack surface, and it'll make it really hard for threat actors to be able to get around that. Now, there's obviously lots of different implementations of multi-factor authentication, and there's tons of ways in which you could bypass it. You know, there's the whole adversary in the middle type of situation where you the threat actor sets up infrastructure that looks like a legitimate company site, and they convince a user or a victim to log into that lookalike, you know, attacker controlled infrastructure, and the authentication ends up getting passed to the real server, so that the attacker server ends up getting the cookies and sees the username and password. So
yes,
there's ways around it. There's other ways to steal cookies and then log in. But again, the goal is to reduce the attack surface as best as you can, and removing reliance on SMS-based authentication, which I know it's very hard and it's going to take a long time to do it, but that will help reduce the attack surface. And relying on things like FIDO2 authentication will really help.
That's great. Charles, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's always good to talk to you, Jeremy.